I would like to concentrate on a single word this morning, but I need to remind you first that words are not static, not frozen forever into a single shape. They melt and shift and change all the time. They mean one thing today, something else tomorrow. I thought I might dramatize that by bringing from home one volume of a 12-volume set called the Oxford English Dictionary. It was already out of date on the day it came off the press 80 years ago, and it took one man an entire lifetime just to prepare a supplement, which was also out of date by the time he had finished it. If you walk over here later and open this book to almost any page, you will discover that it is a kind of morgue for dead words, hundreds and thousands of dead words, words that are not ever going to be resurrected, but once had life and danced on the tongues of living people. And you would also find words that look quite familiar and sound familiar, but once had totally different meanings from the ones they have today. And this volume, I might tell you, since most of you will not come closer to it, includes only the letters O and P. So any student of the language has to keep buying new dictionaries because the words won't stay still and some of them won't even stay alive. My first college dictionary is hopelessly out of date, and if I have slept beside it linguistically for 20 years like Rip Van Winkle, so am I. And if the church goes to sleep, then it gets stuck with Bible translations that are out of date and with language in its worship life that has no correlation with the language of its common life. So let's talk about one of the words the church has had trouble with. If I say it, the word saint, and let it hang in the room for a moment while you think about it, I suppose you begin by recalling people who became famous and were canonized, people for whom churches are named, like St. Paul or St. Joan or St. Thomas, towering figures, heroic, martyred, so far out of the ordinary that it's hard to think of them as real people at all. So that it would never occur to you to think of yourself as a saint. And if someone in a moment of deep gratitude were to call you one, you'd be embarrassed. We profess humility in one way by saying, well, I'm not a saint, but I'll do the best I can. All of which means that we have completely lost the original sense of that word as it was used in Scripture and in the early Christian church, where, by the way, it was used constantly. Letters from Paul start out like this: to all God's beloved in Rome, called to be saints. To the church of God which is at Corinth, with all the saints. To all the saints who are at Philippi. In other words, everyone who had, by choice, entered the Christian community was a saint. The word had nothing to do with being more holy and exalted than all the other Christians. It was simply a descriptive term for anybody who had joined the church. It defined a calling, a profession. If you want a modern example, people today who study certain books and pass the bar and enter practice are called lawyers. Some of them are capable, some are inept. Some are noble, some are sleazy. Most of them are somewhere in between, but they are all lawyers. So in the first meaning of our word, the ancient biblical sense, the one we have totally lost, everyone who professes faith in the life and teaching of Christ is a saint. Some are sorry saints, some are feeble, far from holy, but they are all saints because they all responded to an invitation to move toward a better kind of life. Far from perfect, but trying. In the New Testament sense, saints are sinners who have admitted it and come in for help. And this is why the New English Bible, trying to avoid a word which is now badly warped and misused, has translated Paul's language like this: called to be one of his dedicated people. Not called to be saints, the old-fashioned word, but called to be one of his dedicated people. Given what we have done to the word saint, it's a good translation. You aren't embarrassed if I call you dedicated. That doesn't imply more holiness than you can imagine for yourselves. It simply means what saint once meant, that you are set apart for some special use, devoted to a different life from the one you might live without help. And in that sense, I can say to you on any Sunday morning that you are the saints. And yet, of course, we do not resemble at all what the world normally thinks of when it hears that word. We are, at times anyway, more like the saints at Corinth, full-blooded, on-and-off people with all the problems of any other people who are actually alive and who are being pushed and shoved by hormones and hungers, bad memories, and mixed-up ambitions. In Corinth, for example, some of the saints were arrogant and quarrelsome, splitting the church because of rivalries and jealousies. Some of them fought one another in courts of law. Some of them flaunted sexual behavior, which Paul thought would ruin their hopes of growing up. Some of them visited the great temple of Aphrodite and paid for the favors of prostitutes. Some of them even turned the Lord's Supper itself on occasion into a gluttonous and drunken feast. They may have been called, in Goodspeed's translation, to be God's people, but they were about as mixed a bag as my relatives are, or yours. And yet Paul insisted on calling these people saints. So what he meant is that a saint is nothing more than a sinner who has decided to improve herself under the influence of Christ and the church. Set apart, having a vocation, but quite ordinary in all sorts of ways, including the occasional slips and tumbles. In this first sense of the word, a person like any of us in this room who has said, I bring my weakness to this place in the hope of finding strength. I bring my despair in hope of finding confidence. I bring my chaotic and disorderly life in hope of finding peace and purpose. No better than some outside the church, except that we measure ourselves against a higher standard, judge ourselves by a more perfect life and are therefore kept, or should be kept, humble. So that's what it meant once, to be a saint. But one saint would do a little better than another saint. And because we dearly love heroes, we began to elevate those few above the others. Now there's a real saint, somebody would say. And so we began to create the second meaning of our word, and the descriptive term became a title. Not Paul, one of the saints, but Saint Paul. Not Joan, a peasant girl with a passion for freedom under God, but Saint Joan. And over the centuries, we magnified the virtues of such people and forgot their faults until they became superstars, not to be mentioned in the same breath with the likes of us. Able out of their goodness, we felt sure to do miracles and talk with God in ways denied to the rest of us. You know that meaning of the word saint very well, and that's the meaning you have in mind when you say, well, I'm not a saint, but I'll do what I can. I have some problems with capitalizing the word saint, and I think it has distorted some truth. But I can't change history, so I live with the second meaning and wish the first could be resurrected. There is, by the way, a third meaning. As it happens so often, a sacred word becomes secular. And so today we use the word saint to describe people who are good without regard to church affiliation at all. People whose inspiration may have come originally from Scripture or the church, but who may or may not be part of organized religion. Not like Father Damien among the lepers, or Kagawa among the poor of Japan, or Schweitzer in Africa, or Mother Teresa in India, but secular saints. People less clearly identified as doing their good because the church has inspired them to do it. Let me introduce you now to some of these saints, because I think it would be a good way to start the new year. A woman named Helen, who stands for all the families who have adopted foster children who are likely to die of AIDS. Helen is one of 18 such families in Connecticut. And the little girl she has adopted, Denise, has stick arms and legs and deep furrows between her ribs because she is desperately ill. Two tubes run from her nostrils down the back of her neck to an oxygen tank. She wakes up 3 to 6 times a night, and most nights, her foster mother, Helen, takes her into the bed she shares with her husband. She's dwelling in the love, Helen says. She's not going anywhere as long as she feels the love. Helen has risked loving somebody else's child, knowing the child will die, but believing it ought not to happen to a little girl without somebody present to give love and comfort. The doctor prescribes morphine one day recently for Denise's pain, who is not quite 2 years old, and Helen rocks her more often and whispers, "It's okay to go. These arms will hold you again." And soon after, at the hospital, with Helen and her husband and the drug addict birth, mother, all cradling one another and the child, Denise heeds Helen's sweet voice and eyes. One of the saints. And a short, nondescript little man named Michael Greenberg, 60, who for 24 years now has been taking a bag of gloves in a green cotton sack down to the Bowery in Manhattan and giving them away. He looks for someone who won't make eye contact, old, reticent, disoriented. He dangles a pair of gray or maroon woolen gloves and says, "Take them, please. They're free. They're a gift. No strings attached." And then he shakes the trembling hand and leaves. Why? Well, he says he learned it from his dad, who owned a Brooklyn bakery. His dad would stick in an extra coffee cake or sandwich for a poor customer without that customer's knowing it. His dad used to say to the children, "Don't deprive yourself of the joy of giving." But they were poor too, and one cold morning when Michael lost his gloves, he never asked his father to replace them because he felt so guilty about his carelessness. And when his dad died 26 years ago, he started looking for an appropriate memorial. And he decided he would put a pair of gloves on some poor man's hands just as his father had slipped free Danish rolls into his customers' sacks. When he started, he was a sixth grade teacher. He saved from a modest salary to buy 72 pairs of gloves and gave them out. Timidly, at first, he admits, in the Bowery, 72, because 18 is the Hebrew symbol for life, and 4 times life is 72. And sometimes there is a star of hope. He was waiting for a train not long ago at Penn Station when a well-dressed man asked if he were the glove guy. And then he said, "You gave me a pair of gloves on the Bowery 5 years ago, and now I'm married with a couple of kids, and I'd like to give you $20. To buy more gloves." And Michael told him what he tells anyone else who wants to write a check. "No, thank you. You spend the money on gloves and you give them out." He's not a silly saint. He steers clear of dangerous people on the street who he says have gloves anyway, and hunts the little old men and women who are frightened of people. Do they sometimes trade them quickly for a pint of cheap wine? "It doesn't make any difference," Michael says. "When you give a gift, you let it go." Somebody once described a saint as one who makes it easier for the rest of us to believe in God. By one of those strange, wonderful coincidences, weeks after I had planned this sermon, Time magazine came out last week with a lead story entitled, "For Goodness Sake," all about the saints, secular and otherwise, who are trying to make a difference at the end of a decade when, to quote the essay, "the rich got greedier, the poor got needier, and everyone else tended to his own shiny self-interest." Who are they? Well, I'll name a couple. A grandmother in San Francisco, with the workers she has recruited, provides over 1,000 meals a day to help men and women with AIDS. A man in Los Angeles figures out a new way for food banks to get their donations delivered and saves them $55,000 in fees. Another man establishes Covenant House for kids in trouble. A woman in New York City, who is an architectural historian, invents the street sheet, which is simply a map that directs homeless people to the nearest soup kitchen or clothing bank. She gets DuPont to donate waterproof, tear-resistant paper, and she designs the sheets with graphics that are easy to understand so that the disoriented and the illiterate can use them. Her money. A Miami doctor now has 130 volunteer doctors and medical personnel working on 40 patients a day who come from under bridges and highways in South Florida. He has people so eager to help that in the med school where he is a fellow, there is a 3-month waiting list among medical students for a course called the Homeless Elective. Final thought. The saint is not a professor who puts to society a convincing set of arguments. The saint is one who puts before us a life and an embarrassing invitation which we must decide to accept or reject. Or as the Quakers like to say, when the worship is over, the service begins. For all the saints, we give thanks.